Another big pitch is why I had to have a car, because Lynn would have one. You know, those kids played that on me. My kids played that on me later. Well, you know, he's got one. How come I don't have one? You know that, how that works if you got kids.
Yes.
So, anyway, the first thing I wanted to do is to do some things with the car. Hop it up. That was the thing to do. Hop it up. You get some Edelbrock heads and a couple of 97 carburetors and an Edelbrock manifold and do some other things. Those are all from the outside that you could bolt on. Those are bolt-ons. You didn't get into the heavies, which was camshafts and, you know, aluminum pistons and stuff like that. I didn't even get a chance to think about that hardly. But somehow I finagled or traded or stole or whatever and got and wound up with the... I wasn't adverse to doing that either, I've got to tell you, because, I don't know, you felt like Robin Hood, you know, you didn't have the money and somebody else had it, and why not, you know, it's terrible when you talk this way, but I got to be honest about it, and that, you know, there was a lot of things that, I know one day somebody stole my wheel cover, so I went out and stole another set, so, you know, I was justified. One didn't have the same guy, so that was the problem, but anyway, the two things that I wanted to do with this 32 Ford, the other thing I did, this car did not have solid hood sides. Now, that was a big thing. You didn't want those doggone louvers. You got rid of those, and you went down to the metal shop, or a guy that used to make ducts for your home for heating, or any kind of a place that was good at this, and you'd have this guy make you a set of solid hood sides. And I got to tell you, boy, when you had solid hood sides on that 32 Ford 3-minute coupe with 16-inch Kelsey wheels under the wheel covers, you couldn't go much further. From an outside standpoint, I had a good paint job on it. It was powder blue, never forget it. And it had the chrome dash. That was all there. But there were a couple of things that I wanted to do to it. One of them was to get that funny-looking radiator cap and have a smooth nose on that 32 Ford grill. And that was a must. You had to have that just like you had to have breakfast in the morning. That was a must. If you had a 32 Ford through in a coupe, and somebody hadn't done that to this car, they'd gone part of the way, and then they'd traded in on something. So it had the funny old cap out there that you had to line up with the moldings that went around it. Mm-hmm. And it was out there in front of God and everybody. So I had to get rid of that. So I did that. Did a lot of the work myself, because I couldn't afford to have somebody else do it. But then I had to get somebody help me with the lighting in of this thing. It takes the shell off, which is a big job. And I did a lot of that myself, but I didn't do all of it. And then, of course, you got to paint it again. So I got that. So I had the front of the car fixed. Now the next thing you did to a 32 Ford, and that was just like that's like as necessary as anything you can mention. You had to go around the back of the car, and you had to do some things back there because the way Henry Ford built it in 32, there were those funny taillights that would come out on the stocks with the round lights. That was no good. You didn't want that. So what you put in there was a 39 Ford taillight. Now that was as necessary as getting up in the morning. You just had to do that because that was mandatory equipment for any guy that was anything in the California basin. When you went out to Carl's Drive-In and you pulled in there with those funny looking taillights on the back of that neat fender, you were scoffed at. You know, the girl with the roller skates that would come up to the window to give you the malt and a hamburger would not wait on you. So anyway, So then I had to get a set of, and I found a wreck over on Avalon. It's a place that I used to haunt because they get these neat wrecks in there, and they'd let you, like they do today, they'd let me, I don't know, because I got to know the guy, I guess, or he felt sorry for me or whatever, I don't know, but anyway, he'd let me go in there and take the taillights off. Anything I wanted I could take off a car before they put it, you know, balled it up and sent it to Japan, which later came back to us in the form of bombs. But in any event, you could go over there and you could find a 39 Ford. They were hard to find because everybody was looking for those darn taillights. They were called CCs. And if you edit this out, I'll tell you what we called them. You know what CC stood for? No. Cow's cunts.
Ah.
Yeah, they were known as CC taillights, and they were elliptical shaped, like teardrop shaped, but the teardrop heavy side, the major lifts at the top, and they were pointed at the back.
Mm.
And then after you got those, then what you did, you got the special lens, which had the blue dot in it, and that, boy, you could go no further. That car was from the back with those CCs with the blue dot. The next thing you wanted to do, and about all you could do, is get rid of the frame horns, which stuck out, and the gas tank was back up because the 32 had the gas tank in the back, unlike the Model A, which was up in the cowl. And of course, it was the first one with a fuel pump for Ford, and they only built that whole series 1 year, as you well know.
Yes.
And that was a terrific year. There wasn't an ugly 32 Ford in that whole lineup. That was a beautiful year. Why they only kept it 1 year, I don't know, but 33, they went to a different body, and 34 was the same as the 33, and then 35, they changed again.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a one-year body shot, where the Model A was really 4 years, 20, 29, 30, and 31. But anyway, 32 was kind of a vintage year. But they didn't. They had the gas tank in the back with the frame horns that would come back over it. So the next thing that you'd do with that 32 Ford, if you really wanted to be cool at the drive-in, you would French in that back or put a panel over that thing. And I did that on that car. And I don't know why I didn't blow myself to kingdom come, because I took it over to school and I had the welding torch on. The gas tank is underneath this thing and I'm welding up this thing. Anyway, got that number fixed, and that made it cool from the back. And of course then you torch the springs, which made it ride like you could feel every, you know, tar strip and cigarette, one of these in the street when you hit one. But anyway, you torch the springs, which was blasphemous to do. But they'd got the car low. In those days, a low car at the back was the thing to have. It predates the low riders that you see the Braceros driving out there today. But in those days, a high front and a low back was the thing to have. That was the in thing in the California area. So all the time this was going on, I ran into a guy by the name of Ed Eskandarian, beautiful guy. Not beautiful in the term of being beautiful, because boy, that he wasn't. But he's an Armenian kid. And we got to be really close friends, because he was in a Muroc Dry Lake and El Mirage and all of that. He was in a Hot Rods right up to his Gazoogie. And he liked my 32 Ford, and I was going to Dorsey High School, and he was kind of a loner. And I guess I wasn't exactly a loner, but I wasn't into sports. I'm still not very much into sports. Well, I went nuts last Sunday at the Super Bowl, but anyway, I guess everybody did. But I wasn't really into sports. And at Dorsey High School, they had a hell of a football team, so I'm told. And they were really into football, and I wasn't into football. And they were into baseball, and I wasn't into baseball. I was into model airplanes still. I still went to Jepson's class, and he knew I liked airplanes so well. Jepson was the drafting teacher, and a hell of a neat guy. And I became good friends of his. And he knew that I was a car nut as well. I wore these two hats. I was airplanes and I was cars. And at that point, I wasn't sure which one I liked the best. But I kind of liked, because I'd graduated from, gone through the gamut of airplanes to gas models. They didn't have, well, they did have radio control over a couple of them. When one showed up out there, my God, it was like a holiday. The big set looked like an Atwater Kent, the big stick. Today they got the craft units that are the transmitters are this big, and the little servos, and God knows. Anyway, so once in a while Jepson would go out and join Jack and I out to Gotch Airport, and he had a pretty neat car. He had a 36 Ford 3-window coupe, and that was a neat car. And he had the bars on the hood. That was something I had a 36 Ford, but I never could afford those. Mm-hmm. And so he was kind of a cool guy to me, because, well, you know, he had this feel for cars that was kind of neat. I liked that. And I was into customizing these crazy hot rods in those days. So old Jepson and I in Linwood all went to, you know, Linwood's a couple years ahead of me. So he was a senior when I was just in the 10th grade. But we all belonged to his model airplane club, because Jepson was a drafting teacher. But he also had this model airplane club, and we used to have, you know, meets every once in a while. And he liked gas models, but it was kind of deemed to be either too expensive, which was probably the case, or a little too sophisticated maybe for the other kids that weren't as knowledgeable as Linwood and I. You know, we gas models for a couple of years, and but he really, I think that's why he kind of favored us. But we started a model airplane club there, and so then I was back to the rubber-powered models a couple of times, because the rest of them couldn't afford gas models, and that was a little too exotic for them. But anyway, we used to have a little fun with that, not too much. But anyway, got to be a good friend of Ed Eskandarian, who is a very famous guy now. He makes racing cams for everybody and his brother, and you can't pick up a Hot Rod magazine without seeing an Ed Eskandarian racing cam in it. But the war was on the horizon at that time, and Ed and I became good buddies, and I'd go out from Muroc with him. He used to have a V8T, and I could never aspire. I had my little 32 Ford, and we'd have a lot of fun with that one, but because his T, he was always working on that, and he never had anything to drive. He never had enough money to buy another car. So he and I became good buddies. In the meantime, Linwood had graduated, and he'd gone off to do something else. I don't know what he was doing. I guess he was working. I don't know what he was doing. But anyway, I still keep track, even to this day, I keep track of Jack. But anyway, he was, I don't know, he started going with this girl, and he was going steady. Well, finally, I wound up marrying. He's married all his years. And I, you know, once he got with her, well, you know, I never saw him anymore. The airplanes were out the window, and he had his car and all that stuff, so never saw much of Jack after that, in those years. So I got to be good friends with Ed Eskandarian. And Eskandarian was kind of a loner. He was kind of a unusual-looking guy. If this is ever printed, I wouldn't want you to use the word, you know, ugly or anything. But he was a weightlifter. That was his hobby, in addition to getting his Model T Ford, which was a far cry from a T. The only thing it was T about was the sheet metal on the deck and the cowl and maybe the doors. Everything else was, you know, it was a really a hot car. Really was a hot car. Even by today's standards, it'd be a hot car. And Ed was a genius as far as mechanics are concerned. And he used to live over on Washington Avenue. And his dad, I don't know whatever happened to his mother. I never met his mother, but his dad was a shoemaker. And Ed Eskandarian, like I, it was only a few blocks from, or well, a couple miles from where we lived. I lived in the back of a store. Well, he lived upstairs over a store. That was another scenario that a lot of people did. You know, they had the store downstairs and the apartment upstairs. Well, Ed and his dad and his brother lived upstairs. And he had his little shop, little garage out back. And his old man was from Armenia. And Ed and I got to be good friends. And we'd go in my 32 Ford 3-1 coupe. We'd go over to the skating rink. I used to like to roller skate. It's about the only sport I ever really participated in. That was a method of contacting the opposite sex pretty well. Because, boy, that was a place you'd pick the girls up in those days. Boy, if you could skate and, you know, skate backwards, particularly, that was a big deal. I used to be able to skate backwards. Can't now. Geez, it'd fall right on my ass. But anyway, I would cut a pretty good figure out there on the, and Ed was very interested in meeting girls, but he was too embarrassed. A very shy guy. He still is. But anyway, he was very reluctant about, you know, trying to meet girls. He'd rather work in the garage and get his F-head Model T and do some camshafts and do some work in that garage, and all his money, whatever he had, he would get something chrome-plated, you know, the frame or the steering column or the front axle or whatever. The car was almost, and that was the thing to do, was to chrome everything that showed in those days. If it didn't move, you'd chrome it, you know. And so anyway, he had this beautiful T that he was always working on, never had anything to drive, so I'd go over there, my 32, and we'd go down to Culver City to the roller skating rink. And we'd go in there, and Ed couldn't roller skate very well, but boy, could he lift weight. He had a little story here. He had been lifting weights, I guess, ever since he was about 10 years old. And he had a shape on him that looked like King Kong's muscular brother. He almost looked like one of these guys you see on the TV once in a while, like Arnold Schwarzenegger. He really did. He had a shape damn near as wild as Schwarzenegger's. Terrific pectoral muscles and the deltas. And, you know, God, he was into this thing, and he was always, God, he could lift a model, a V8 engine block up and put it over his head. I know he used to do that. And they were heavy in those days, and it seemed really, but anyway, one day, I don't know what the hell was the matter. I guess his Ford was running, his T was running, and I was probably low on gas or something. I left my car home, I took it over to his place, and we jumped in his T. We're going down to see if we can pick up some girls. Where we'd put them, if we picked them up, I don't know. But he wasn't worried about that, because he would have been worried about that, and we wouldn't have gone, probably, because he was so shy. But anyway, we get down to the Culver City Roller Roll, and Ed didn't want to go in. I don't know, he was too embarrassed. I said, come on, Ed, we can go in and meet these girls. So now, so he says, I think we, why don't we go up to Carl's or wherever, guys. Carl's the place we usually went to. So we get out in the middle of this, right in front of this road, and they were just coming out. It was 11 o'clock or something. It was too late to go in anyway. And the girls were coming out with the skates girl over their shoulders and the little shorts and stuff, slacks. And Ed gets in the middle of this street. Here was a roller roll here, and it was a big street. It went down to Sepulveda. So Sepulveda down here, and I don't know what the hell this was, Culver City Boulevard, whatever. So the girls are all streaming out of this place here, and the guys too, of course. And so Ed's parked right here, and I'm with him in this Model T. He hits the wood with his foot on this thing. We did about two circles out here, and then he takes off going this way. And he literally just flaming, smoky blue rubber going all over the place, a terrible, horrendous noise, all this in this V8 engine, which no pipes, no, and I mean pipes, but no mufflers, this tremendous F-head engine, which he had designed and put in this thing. The hell, he used to run it up to Muroc at, you know, over 100 miles an hour consistently. And but this was on the street, no plates, nothing. So anyway, we get up here, there's another street that comes in at an angle, and he pulls up there and he stops. And I looked around over my left shoulder, I'm on the right side, he's there, and he's got a white t-shirt on. He's got these muscles. He looks like an ape, and he's got a forehead that's maybe an inch high, but where his hairline starts. He's got eyebrows, and then his hairline starts here. And his ears come out like this. And he's got a big nose, and he's got his 5 o'clock shadow. You know, it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And anyway, here is this creature, and he's driving this car. He's just done a 360 plus another half a turn, and gone up the street. Had stopped at this boulevard stop, which was unusual for Ed. And I looked around, and God, here's these cops in this 36 Ford white-sided highway patrol car that come up and pull up in front of the car, so he could have backed up, but he didn't try. So they get out of the car, and both of them get out of the car, and they're adjusting their hats. It was like a scene out of American Graffiti, I guess. But anyway, they came up, and this one guy goes up to Ed, and the other guy comes over to me, and Jesus, they had their hands on their hip. You know, they didn't pull the guns, but it looked like they were gonna. And God, I just kept my mouth shut. And they walked over, this one cop, kind of a big rotund guy, looked like a guy out of a Smokey and the Bandit, big stomach, comes up, and he's looking down at Ed, and he said, "I'd like to see your driver's license." So Ed fished it out of his wallet, and he's moving, hardly muscle bound, he could hardly get to his wallet. So he hands the guy the license, and the guy looks at it, and he said, "Ed Eskandarian?" And I says, "Yep." All the time he's looking at him, the other cop's looking at him, and he's got this white t-shirt on and his rippling muscles, and he says, "What are you? Are you a pugilist?" And Ed looks at him, he says, "No," he says, "I'm an Armenian." And you know, that cop broke him up so bad, those guys laughed so bad, they let us go. Jeez. "You a pugilist?" "No," he says, "I'm an Armenian." God, never forget that one. But anyway, we used to have a lot of fun. But. So anyway, Ed finally went off to war, and he got his business started. He got in the, what the hell do they call it, they deliver all the stuff across, not Merchant Marine, but it's the Air Corps version of that. I don't know, it was in the Air Force, and it was a supply area for coming back to the States from over in the islands. And he'd stop off at Hawaii. But anyway, Ed got involved in that thing, and how he got his money, or his start really in his business, he was a hell of an entrepreneur and a hell of a trader and a swapper and all that stuff, and he was always in this kind of a natural affinity for being able to horse trade and do it well and make a lot of money at it. But he would buy watches. Don't ask me where the hell he got them, but he'd come into L.A. and San Francisco, and he'd buy these cheap watches, and they'd take them in his duffel bag and put them on the airplane. They'd go back to the islands, and he'd buy whatever he could, you know. Mm-hmm. Liquor was big, but it was tough to get during that year, those years. But whatever he could buy that you couldn't get, you know, on Guadalcanal or any of the other islands over there, he flew into that one, Taiwan. He was all over the South Pacific, and he made a lot of money. He'd sell his stuff to the GIs because they had money and no place to put it, you know. So he came back with, I don't know, at that time it seemed like a lot of money, but he had about $30,000. And that's the way he started his business, really. But anyway, the last time I came back here finally after the war, and the first trip I ever had to Detroit here was for the Golden Jubilee in 1946. And I'd never been out of the nest up until that time, really. And all the time I was out in California, I was going to art school. I was going to Art Center when they were over on 3rd Street. And I didn't go full-time because, of course, my mother by this time had fallen and broken her leg, her hip, actually. And she never walked again after that. But she'd give painting lessons from, you know, from her bedside.
Sure.
And with the kids too. She still had the kids for 50 cents an hour. They'd come in and they'd line up and they'd bring it over to her and she'd show them how to change it and what they should be doing to make it look good. And then Ma and Pa would come in and, gee, the kids had done a fine job. My mother painted half it, but they, you know, that was all right. But so she had fallen and broken her leg, and that was the end of her driving, which was also getting bad. I don't think her leg had broken it. She had a frozen knee that was arthritic, and so she couldn't, it wouldn't bend, and when she fell down, she never got up again. But anyway, so now where are we? We're, I'm out of high school, I guess, and I've been going to art school for a long time. Every time I get some bucks together, I was...
When you go to the art center?
Went to Art Center Nights.
Mm-hmm.
And I went there so long ago that it was down MacArthur Park. I don't, can't remember the name of the street now, but they used to have a... when the school first started down there, under a guy by the name of Tink Adams.
Was that originally called Griffith Park?
No, I think Griffith Park was further over towards Glendale.
So it had nothing
Park.
To do with...
this is
General,
MacArthur Park.
General MacArthur.
I don't know. I suspect not, because he wasn't really very famous at that time. But it was called MacArthur. It might have been Griffith Park. I don't know. You're making me wonder. But anyway, I went there for a while nights and took some classes as I could afford it, which was not very often. But once my mother broke her leg, you know, the small amounts of money that she had coming in really went out the window. And all the time she was trying to, you know, do what she wanted me to do, which was go to art school and paint. God, she was used to nag me something fierce on painting. Well, she didn't get very far with that, but I used to like to draw because of my model airplane thing. I used to design. It wasn't very much designing, but I dropped these airplanes and I'd build them from that and from the drawings. And I mean, I learned to draw in perspective, which is kind of came natural to me anyway, because my mother's influence, if nothing more. And I used to like to draw with a pencil. But I never really liked painting very much, particularly oil painting. Probably goes back to the wall hangings and the canvas and all that stuff. I was so close to it, I didn't want any part of it. I didn't like the smell of that linseed oil and stuff, you know, really. But watercolors, if she had, she was a very good watercolor artist when she was young. But as she got older, she got out of watercolor stuff, and she never did watercolor. I never saw her do a watercolor. I have, to this day, a couple of paintings that she did, watercolors. But I never saw her do any watercoloring. She didn't like it very much. She used a lot of China painting. Everybody did that too. It was all the rage. But she taught that, as a matter of fact, in one of her classes there. But anyway, so now I guess I'm out of high school. I'm going to school nights whenever I could get some bucks together and trying to keep everything going. And I almost, it was so close, my senior year in high school, it was about this far, Dave, of my having to quit and work full-time because my mother had broken her leg, and she wasn't, the income was, we were on a thing called, well, today they call it welfare, but my mother was a down east Yankee, being from Portland, Maine, and she was so independent that she would never, until we almost literally starved, she would never go on, they called relief. She would not go on that till the very last, and finally my aunt couldn't have much more money either. Finally, talked to her into applying for relief, and we got relief, and we survived with that.
Mm-hmm.
And the restrictions were so heavy, you had to sell a car, you know, that's what, but it wasn't that, didn't matter anyway, because she wasn't driving very much, but I had one, and they allowed us to have a car if I drove it, and I was very young, but when you're on relief, you usually couldn't have a car. They'd come in, and they'd look through your possessions and all that stuff, and but she was able to get, she never got, you know, as much money as anybody else got, because she did have this little business going there, and it was not much coming from that. But I can remember, too, when we lived on Western Avenue, we had this combination, you know, art shop and model shop and scooter shop. I can remember going across to the market guy, and we'd buy a thing called, well, the first place, I'd go back to the butcher, and he'd give me an old bone that he'd shaved all the meat off of, and a big, I can remember... a big joint with a little meat and a lot of mostly suet or fat on it.
He had the marrow, too.
He had the marrow, that's right. And so he would, I don't think we paid, I think he'd give me that. I don't remember now, but it wasn't very much if I paid for it. And then he'd buy a 10 cents worth of soup, soup vegetables, they call it. And they had a deal, you know, a lot of people come in there and they'd give it a little bit of this, it's old, it's 3 days old, it wasn't rotten, but it was well used, you know, it's got tons of miles on it. And they'd give you, you know, lettuce and spinach, tomatoes and potatoes and stuff like that. Potatoes are pretty hearty. You got a lot of potatoes, you're really pretty lucky because those held up pretty good and they were fast movers, so they didn't spoil very often. But they throw a few of those in. And, you know, for a dime, you get a big brown bag full of it, and then you take the soup bone and throw it in the deal, and you'd have enough to eat, all right. And then oatmeal, geez, that was cheap in those days. I don't know why oatmeal was so cheap. It isn't today, but... Or cream of wheat, that was another one. Jesus, yeah, another biggie. Mm-hmm. And boy, I'll tell you, the cream of wheat or oatmeal in the morning and the soup at night, that was something. And then once in a while, you'd have some money, enough money to buy. My mother she wasn't the world's greatest cook. She had a lot of features and virtues, and she was a super person, but she hated to cook. It was a waste of time. She didn't like it. Cooked only because it was necessary. And she had one formula. I wish I had it for... Well, my wife's pretty good at that, but we had to... She had a thing called, it was an Eastern fish, I think they call it fish stew or fish?
Chowder.
Chowder, fish chowder, thank you.
Oh, yeah.
Fish chowder, and God, I'm telling you, to this day, I love that.
I do too, yeah.
And, you know, you put some little chunks of pork in it that are fried or whatever they do to it, and boy, I'll tell you, that is really good. That fish chowder is good with milk, and, you know, God, it's delicious. So that was one I really look forward to. That one, she could afford the fish to go in the fish chowder and the vegetable. And but that was fun. Another thing was really cheap in those days, and we used to eat a lot of that. Could never afford, you know, real beef. But the thing that was very cheap, it's hard to believe today, is liver.
Oh yes.
And liver was, yeah, that was, you know, yeah, that was entrails. You just throw that out, or
exactly.
You give it away, or something. It was very, very cheap.
And kidneys also.
And kidneys too. That's
and
right.
Heart.
Oh yeah, and heart. Oh yeah, I always loved beef heart. You know, they'd slice that up. You know, and she'd put some kind of stuffing inside of it, and you'd slice that bear up.
Sounds like
that was
my
good.
Mother.
Yep.
Exactly.
Yeah. Same period. You know. But so those were the.
To this
the Depression
day, stuffed baked heart is a delicacy.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's damn good. I still like it.
Yeah.
And chicken, Jesus, chicken was cheap, and I used to love chicken, too. I still do.
Mm-hmm.
But steak, my God, that was something you had maybe once a year. But these kids today, I'll tell you, I know I sound like the world's oldest living man or something saying that, but they don't realize that's something that happened long before, you know, they started counting time. But, and particularly, I think out in California, it was probably hit as bad out there as anywhere because there were so many people out there. They didn't have the heating bills to pay, at least. And I think, you know, a lot of people, the Grapes of Wrath, my Steinbeck, you know, they were all heading for California.
Right.
The Jobs, or whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
But,
You saw a lot of that.
Interesting years. Oh, yeah, sure, sure.
The camps that they put them in.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad, when he was living, though, he had a good job. He was with Richfield Oil. And before he got killed in 31, I guess it was, I still got a Christmas card. He must have written as he was going out the door before he got hit. 31, I think it's 31. It might be 32, 31. 31. And anyway, he had a good job. He was an engineer with Richfield Oil, petroleum engineer. And I never really knew him that well because he got killed so early. But... he was making a fabulous amount of money. It really was in those days. It was $650 a month.
Mm-hmm.
And he was an executive. He wasn't a VP, but he was up there pretty good. He was a manager of some obscure division. And they paid him well, and I still have a lot of the old yellowed newspapers that are tell about when it, because he lived for 3 days, and every day they'd have a condition kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
He was Richfield Oil executive hit by a drunk.
Mm.
But, so, anyway, I'm going to school. I'm out of high school, or getting close to getting out of high school. And I liked to draw very much, and the war had come along. I graduated in 42. I was 18 the previous December, December 7th. And I turned 18 right after that. And, of course, being interested in airplanes, I wanted to get the Royal Canadian Air Force. I wanted to get in the air for fly airplanes because I knew all of the essentials of aircraft and had been involved with it, you know, models. But and I was 18. I thought, well, I'm gonna shoot a letter off to Canada and join the RCAF. And that didn't work out because I had one eye. No way you could do that. So that didn't work out at all. I got a courteous reply that there's no way that they're going to hire a trainee for RCAF with a single orb. Because I could be pretty selective, you know, the war was just starting then. But so what do? Well, I couldn't afford to go to college, of course, but I was still going to school nights. And I had this problem with my mother to keep her going. And she was kind of deteriorating anyway because her joints were freezing up very bad. And, you know, it was diet. God, she never had enough to eat hardly. And anything she'd have, she'd give to me anyway. But so the arthritis was taking a toll on her, and then she was in bed with a broken hip, which was never going to heal. She could hardly walk when she broke her hip, so that was bad grits. But so I decided I was going to, they were talking about drafting people and all that stuff. So I got a job at Northrop Aircraft. I went over there because I was interested in aircraft again. Same thing keeps coming up. And wasn't much action in cars except for, you know, once the war got here, you had to have C rations and D cards and all that stuff. And couldn't drive very much, and that was a big blow to me because I love to drive around and go places and stuff. And so I got this job at Northrop Aircraft in the illustration department, working for a guy by the name of Paul M. Brown. It's too bad you couldn't get him on tape. He's gone now. And he died quite young. But anyway, Paul Brown, probably if I were to look back on some of the things that influenced my getting into the design end of automobiles, probably Paul Brown would have to be one of the top reasons and influences, because Paul Brown had worked for Harley Earl, General Motors. He was in the Buick studio. He was in a number of studios. He was kind of a fireman. He's a damn good designer. And so I went to work for him. Fate works its wondrous things, ways. And the war was really, we're really into the war in a heavy, heavy manner. And Paul Brown was head of the illustration department, production illustration as it was called in those days, or technical illustration, later called. But production illustration, and I'm sure you know what it is, but maybe for that tape I'll describe it. They had, well, these engineering drawings were rather difficult to read to the layman, and so this kind of a profession was born, due in large measure to a guy by the name of Tracy. I still have his book. And so I took a course from Mr. Tracy called Production Illustration, and I could draw pretty well anyway, but this, not like I was able to do after I came out of that class. I took that down to SC, University of Southern California, and Tracy himself, can't remember his first name, Robertson Tracy or Robbins Tracy or something. Anyway, I've got the book. Still got it after all these years.
What's the title?
I'll have to call you on that. I could put my hand on it in my library, but it's called Production Illustration. But it's by this guy Tracy. I can't think of his first name. But anyway, I took that course again nights. My God, I went to school so many nights that, you know, I felt like an owl or something. You know, I was up all night and all day too in those days. But I was going to SC and taking that course, and then I was going to Art Center and taking other courses in drawing logic and lettering and layout. And they didn't have design in those days; they weren't teaching it, at least. But it was all kind of, it was using your common sense and your brain and your ability to transfer your gray matter to a thing in your hand called a pencil or a paintbrush or whatever. So all of those things helped, I guess, a little bit along the way. And This class was a very good one, and I had that as a background when I went into with my application blank to Paul Brown. And I'd heard about, of course, obviously heard about technical illustration or production illustration, as it was called, and that seemed a logical place that I'd like to work. I wasn't an engineer by background, and I was 18 years old anyway. And I didn't want to do any production work, you know, riveting or whatever, although I was going with a girl at the time that was, I used to call her Rosie the Riveter. Anyway, the only interest I had in that was that I would be working in the same department that she was working in, because I was really interested in that time, you know, puppy love. Thank goodness that didn't work out, because it never would have worked out. But in any event, I went to Northrop, I guess primarily because she worked there, at least as far as applying for the job is concerned. And while I was there, of course, I met Paul Brown. And I showed him my portfolio, such as it was, and, you know, a lot of information I'd had from my model airplane building days and what I'd done to my 32 Ford and the 36 Ford that I'd subsequently had after that. And so he was kind of impressed, and he knew I was a car guy. He could see it in me, I guess. And he said, well, I said, why don't you start with us? So I said, okay, good. So they were looking for people desperately, and particularly somebody that looked like they had the possibility of being a 4F and could stay with them for a while, which is exactly what happened. And so anyway, Paul Brown hired me, and I can remember he was he had some mannerisms that were really, really unique. He never smoked, but he used to pull his lip. And he'd come by and he'd say, hey, Teague, what are you doing? And I said, well, I'm doing a main spar of the B-49 or whatever, and or I'm doing a lower ball sight for a B-35 or whatever I was working on. And he said, how'd you like to talk about cars for a little while? I said, sure, great. So, God, I'd go up to his office and we'd talk about cars. I'm 18 years old, and here's this guy's old. You know, he's like 30. And he says, you think you'd really like to design cars? And I said, yeah. And he said, well, hey, I'll bring some drawings in. And he liked to show off anyway. He was a neat guy. I mean, I say that lovingly. I don't mean it maliciously at all. But he did like to show off. He had an ego like all of us have, I guess, at some point. And so he brought this his portfolio in. And God, they talk about that world opening up with the model airplane engines, you know, with the gas models versus the rubber band. Boy, that really lifted the curtain on an area that changed my life. And he showed me these Maitianus drawings. That's a French watercolor paper. And that was the technique that was used. Maitianus. Oh, God, boy, you're talking the wrong guy. Maitienes, I guess, Maitianus. You can buy it at Lewis Art Supply here in town. Mm-hmm. Anyway, he showed me a number of these illustrations that he'd made. They're watercolor and prismacolor and pencils and, you know, airbrush and all that sort of thing. And God, I was just absolutely zonked out. It just really got me. I thought, my God, that's it. That is what I want to do someday. Of course, we had this thing called a war going on, and so I had to keep my nose to the grindstone there. But and then it looked like I was going to get drafted, and I damn near did get drafted because they were going to draft me for limited service, you know, bookkeeping or some damn thing. And I came a hair's breadth from going in the Army anyway as a something of that type, or running a store or something, you know, supply. Because they had a lot of openings for that, because they wanted the other guys to get shot that would go out and get shot. So I came very close to it, and I had to get a special, you know, deferment and all that stuff that you...
Exemption,
yeah. I think they call it a deferment. Exemption. Right. It was an exemption, but I think they kind of...
It was a deferment.
Deferment. And about every 6 months, you know, they'd look at that thing again, like you're going to throw your tailbone in some kind of a crazy bookkeeping job. But Paul Brown said, no, he said, this guy's good, and I was getting a lot better than when I first started, because I was really kind of a trainee. But I'd taken this course and was continuing to take the courses at SC that would make me proficient at being a technical illustrator, a production illustrator. And it came easy for me anyway, because I liked to draw and it was not difficult, I didn't think. And, you know, I knew how to read blueprints because of all my model airplane building days with the Cleveland kits down here, which were difficult to read. And so I'd take these blueprints, and for the uninitiated, we used to call them Okies, which was an unfair term. But a lot of the guys that had come out from the Midwest to California to work in the aircraft industry and were swept up in that whole thing were not proficient at reading blueprints. And so the technical illustrator, the production illustrator, of course, would read all the blueprints and make a perspective drawing to show the parts exploded and what rivet went where and what the spacing was between the two. And it's really a simplified perspective blueprint is about what it is. And so, God, I made a jillion of those things. And we were working overtime, and then I got moved to the night shift. And anyway, I was working a lot of work. And I remember I started at 75 cents an hour because I was still wet behind the ears, and I was 18 years old. But, you know, 75 cents an hour, you know, that kept food on the table pretty well for my mother and I.
Yeah.
And it was quite a ways away. It was in Hawthorne, and, of course, we lived in near Baldwin Park. That seemed like a long ways. It really wasn't. But when you didn't have any gas, it was a long ways. And you used to have these carpools and all that stuff.
Uh-huh.
And, you'd pick up the other guys and then take off. So you did a lot of that during the war. But anyway, the war... All through this period, my friend Paul Brown, every once in a while, he'd bring another drawing in that he'd found. I knew he knew where it was at, but he'd say, just trying to keep me going, you know. About every 6 months, he'd bring one in. Some of them were framed there on his wall, I guess. And he'd get me fired up on this automobile end of the thing. He said, you know, Teague, he said, if you really like cars as much as I think you do, he said, someday, he said, you want to go back there to Detroit, and he said, freeze your ass off, and he says, and he was right there, and he said, you want to get in the automobile business, he said, because that's a great profession, he said, I'm going to go back there when the war's over. He says, although I'm pretty much in love with California here, and I got a pretty good job, he said, depends, he said, you know, if they still have a production illustration department at Northrop Aircraft, he said, well, I'll probably join it. Can't stay with it because he was the head of the department anyway, and I don't know what he got paid, but it was probably not too bad. And in fact, he did stay at Northrop Aircraft as the head of production illustration long after the war was over, right through Korea. In fact, I went back and worked for him again when the Korean War came along. And he was a hell of a nice guy and a good friend and very influential in my getting interested in becoming an automobile styler. But then, about that time, we had dinner. He said, I want you to meet a couple of guys. He said that are out here in California. He said, when the war's over, they're probably going to go back, too. Turned out to be Buzz Grissinger and Reese Miller. And they lived up in Hollywood on the side of the hill up there. And so I went up to see them one night with Paul Brown. And that, again, opened up another curtain. And here I saw Grissinger's work and Reese Miller's work, and they were proficient at the airbrush, where Paul was pretty good, but I'm sure he was good with the airbrush and doing these full-size rendering and stuff, but, you know, he didn't have any of those there. And
They were
in some kind of war. They were probably doing production illustration, too. I don't know. Yeah. Reese could tell you when you talk to him, or Buzz Grissinger.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really not sure what they were doing. They weren't working at Northrop, I can guarantee you that, but they were good friends of Paul Brown, and Paul introduced me to them. And, of course, I was going to Art Center, and they knew everybody over there.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you know, I'd really like to get into this thing. He said, well, hey, why don't you take one of these drawings and loan me a couple of them, and why don't you go see what you can do to, you know, repeat what we've been doing for years. And so I did that, and I got myself some MITNS watercolor paper. And even though we're working a hell of a lot of hours at Northrop, I still managed to find time to do some sketches that I thought were pretty good, because black paper is very easy to work on. It's kind of you don't have to show a lot. You can just a couple of highlights, and you can get the whole, let the paper do the work for you. And that paper comes in many different colors. I mean, almost all colors that you'd want, but black seemed to be the one that appealed to me the most. And you could get more impact off the drawing with that. But so I'd seen Reese Miller's drawings and Grissinger's drawings, and they were neat guys, really super guys. And I became friends of theirs. So that was another peg point. And then the war got over. War came to a screeching halt. And I kept being haunted by Paul Brown's urging to get into styling back in Detroit. And I had this problem with my mother because she was, you know, she was bedridden, and I didn't have anybody to take care of her. And so that was kind of a problem. I never pursued it very much because I knew I couldn't get her back here, and I couldn't afford to put her in a, well, she would never go to a rest home anyway. That was, boy, that was one thing she filed an early claim on, that she used to call them rabbit hutches. She's never put me in a rabbit hutch. She said, absolutely no way, and never did. I'd had a chloroformer to get her in one of those places, and then she'd say she's going to bite the cord or something, you know, when there's electric cords, if I ever tried to put her in a place like that. Always dramatic threats.
Yeah.
But she never had to do that because I wouldn't. But anyway, that did kind of keep me from pursuing it or trying to get at this, because by this time I'm 21 or 2 or something. So one time, I don't know quite how this happened, but I got the chance to go to work as a kind of a pencil sharpener and a mat framer and a kind of a do whatever you can do. And by the way, if you want to try some styling someday, we'll let you do that sort of thing, with a company by the name of E.H. Daniels. E.H. Daniels, by the way, is a guy you ought to talk to, although he's not a designer. Well, he is. He is, really. But, I never saw him make a drawing. He was more of an administrator type. He had a terrific affinity for being able to, he was a good businessman, is the word I'm trying to say. And he's right down here in Ann Arbor.
Really?
E.H. Daniels. He's a hell of a nice guy. And please give him my, if you mention my name, I'm sure he'll throw you out. No, he won't. He'll like that.
Great.
But E.H. Daniels, and he's in Ann Arbor. And I got a Christmas card for him.
Living in retirement there?
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Good.
And anyway, E.H. Daniels had this contract with the Kaiser Corporation. Now, most people don't know that I ever worked for Kaiser, but I did. And I went over to work for him, and I remember the address. It was 6000 Sunset. It was right in Hollywood. Here I could get at least a taste or a smattering or a feel or a idea of what styling was going to be like, because E.H. Daniels had pulled together, he was an industrial designer primarily. But somehow he knew Edgar Kaiser, the old man, and he knew the son too. But he had gotten some kind of an in with him, and of course this was before they'd even built the Kaiser, and they're just starting to put Willow Run together out here. So I talk about Henry Kaiser. I said Henry Kaiser. Edgar Kaiser's his son.
Yeah.
And anyway, I got an interview with E.H. Daniels, because I think either Miller or Grisinger, one of those guys, I think was the guy that put me on a, why don't you go over here, Teague, and give them an application blank, and and see what they can do. Fill out a form, and maybe they'll hire you. Well, I was cheap, and I was eager. So I went over to see E.H. Daniels, and he was nice enough to take the time, I'll never forget that, to meet me here. I'm a young guy, 21, too, or something. And he said, he says, where's your portfolio? And I said, right here. And I had this thing that I'd gathered, all the sketches I'd made in my spare time at Northrop working for Paul, because whenever I'd do an airplane, I'd do a car, draw some cars. And then I'd done a little work, too, for, I did a cover for Road and Track, as a matter of fact, in 51. And I had that as a kind of a thing, which was pretty good, I guess. And then I'd done a couple of other covers for guys. I used to know a guy by the name of Oliver Billingsley, who's kind of really started Road and Track, and because of my interest in cars in general, and I'd gone to a couple of antique car meets. I was getting into that at that time a little bit.
And it's right after the war.
Yeah, it's right after the war, and I got so damn much trouble with my 36 and my 32 Ford and other things with the law that I went to traffic school, end to end, and I got to be personal. First name, the judge and the traffic bailiff down there that would give the course, and oh God, but I know you again, eh, Teague? So anyway, Daniels gave me a job, and it was kind of neat because it was just up in Hollywood from where I lived in Leimert Park, and that wasn't very far, and the war was over anyway, and I could get gas again, and
and so, had 36 Ford.
So I had my 36 Ford then, three window coupe, of course, and it was powder blue. I liked the powder blue, so I had it painted that color. I did most of the work.
Was Earl Shive just getting started?
It was about like an Earl Shive. I don't know if it was Earl Shive or not, but it was about the same price.
Yeah.
I know where nobody had any money, even after the war, it wasn't very much of it around, but for me at least. So he hired me, And I worked there for a while, not too long, a few weeks, a few months. And while I was there, I met a guy by the name of Bob Robillard, who was also a designer. And he was a friend of both Grissinger and Miller. In fact, it might have been a billiard shot. I might have met Miller and Grissinger, and then they introduced me to Robillard, and Robillard said, "Hey, why don't you come over to E.H. Daniels, and we can hire you as a runner," which is exactly what they did. I was cutting mats and sharpening pencils, and making sure that answer the phone when Gina was not there. She was later Bob married her, a neat gal.
Is Robillard still alive?
Robillard's still alive, and he's out in Hollywood. You might look him up out there sometime. Bob Robillard, just the way it's spelled, it sounds. R-O-B-I-L-L-A-R-D. Okay. Robillard. And he and Gina live up on the... If the airplane ever doesn't make it over the Hollywood Hills where that sign is, they'll run into him. That's where he's at. Uh-huh. God, the house got to be worth $1 billion now. He put it up, and I know he couldn't afford to do it at the time, and he built half of it himself, and he's got about 4 acres up there. Jeez. Fortune. Yeah, you know, 1950 or something, you could do that, 51. Mm-hmm. But, so I worked for E.H. Daniels, and then he said, Bob Robillard's going to be transferred up to Emeryville, or up to Oakland, Kaiser was. They were up there with Dean Hammond, who was an ex-Ford guy, as you probably know, designed the Hammond pusher airplane with a V8 engine mm-hmm. and tail, and
yeah.
twin booms and stuff, mm-hmm. you know, the airplane. Anyway, Dean Hammond was chief engineer there. Working for Kaiser, and Robillard was working for E.H. Daniels, and he needed a guy to help him out up there. So,
what did Daniels do?
It was an industrial design concern, and he actually had the contract to do styling work for the Kaiser. I didn't mention that. I'm glad you. I take this for granted because I know it. Mm-hmm. But he had this contract to do facelifts of the car that Darren had been involved. A lot of guys had been involved in this thing, mm-hmm. developing this lump. But anyway, it looked good after the war because it was one of the first post-war all-new cars. It was really all-new because it was a new nameplate, along with Joseph Frazier and Henry Kaiser whipped this thing together, and they were going to beat the world and go after GM along with Tucker and several others that didn't make it. But in any case... Pardon?
It was a wonderfully optimistic era.
It was. Oh, yes. Oh, God, you could sell anything. You know, you absolutely could. The country was so car-happy when the war was over that they, anything would sell, and sell well. Because there's this pent-up demand for cars, which still there, coming back, I guess, a little bit. But you could sell anything. It didn't matter what it looked like or acted like, so long as it was new and fresh and, that wasn't rusted out and was new car, and it was anything could sell. So E.H. Daniels had the project through his friendship with Edgar Kaiser, that's Henry's son, to... take on this facelift project. And I know, that's when I really got kind of a taste of styling and all. I wasn't doing much invention there. I was doing renderings and things like that. Mm-hmm. I was pretty good at rendering at that time. So the other guys do the design work and the new grills and stuff, and then I do the paste ups I'd sometimes put the washes down and do some of the renderings from somebody else's thing. I enjoyed that. That was fun. It was kind of, I was associating with these designers. Boy, that was really something. And it was right there in California. Didn't have to go all the way back to Michigan. So I went up to, they transferred me, might as well have gone to Detroit, I guess, but they transferred me up with Robillard because he was sent up to Emeryville to work under Dean Hammond with him to do some more work, including some work on the Kaiser building. But they were developing this car up there that was in this business, you got to do two cars ahead of the one you're building. And they were doing just that. They were going to do a small car. It turned out to be the Henry J, but this was before the Henry J, a long time before it. But he was thinking in terms of a small everyman's car, like a Model T or a Superior Chevrolet or something like that. It was going to be a downsized vehicle that would be smaller than the big Kaisers and Frasers. But he was so hung up on the design of that car that what he did, and I worked on this thing a little bit. Henry Kaiser did.
Yes.
He had the orders go out that this car that he was talking about would be a small-scale version of the big one. Keep it exactly the same car, Mr. Robillard, and have, what's his name over there, Teague, help you out on this thing, and I want to see some drawings by day after tomorrow, and they got to be green. Henry Kaiser had a thing about green. You could sell him anything so long as green. He loved green.
And Kaiser, of course, had a fabulous wartime career.
Oh, yeah, yeah. They built the Liberty boats and all that stuff, so they really were. He was very wealthy, made a lot of money in that. And he owned aluminum, still a Kaiser Aluminum Company. Mm-hmm. But, so, anyway, here I'm up in Emeryville, and that was difficult for me because my mother was down here, but I had a wonderful old black lady by the name of Smith who took care of my mother while I was up there. And so that was a tremendous burden off my mind. And, in fact, she took care of... She took care of me once in a while too. She, you know, cooked meals and stuff like that, and did the housework. She was a marvelous, marvelous lady. I loved her, and she looked like Aunt Jemima, big, heavyset gal. God, she didn't take any stuff from my mother, and my mother could dig it out, deal it out too. She was, she could be ornery at times, along with her sweetness. But anyway, Smith took care of her, so that allowed me to work up in Oakland. And this car that we were working on up there was a really a strange beast. He liked the design of the Kaiser that was then just coming out, been out about a year. This is in 46. And it was just coming out, or had been out. We were facelifting it down in 6000 Sunset at E.H. Daniels' place down there. But he opened up this place because he had to be closer to where the cars were being developed. It was kind of their experimental or tech center, if you will, in Emeryville, outside of Oakland. And he tapped me because I was cheap, I guess, and I was not very experienced, but I was willing, and I liked cars, and Robillard and I got along fine. And so anyway, Robillard went up there, and then he no sooner got there and he needed some help, and so he asked Daniels to send me up there. So I went up there, and I was up there on not too long, a couple, 3 months. And then he was, of course, Robillard was going with Gina, the secretary, and he didn't like that very much because he was up there and she's down here, so he wore out the airplanes going back and forth. And then I had to come back to see my mom on a weekend, so I was almost a every other week thing. But they, while I was working there, I never really, I was kind of frustrated because, you know, they knew I didn't have any experience. It's like trying to become a bulldozer driver, and nobody wants to give you a chance to drive in the bulldozer, so, but you got to have experience to get the job. So anyway,
Catch
22. Yeah, Catch 22, exactly. So I was working for E.H. Daniels and up there, and that was inconvenient, and my mother was the only one she had anyway, so she was she missed me, and she wanted me down close to here. So I worked down, back down. This whole thing only lasted about a year. I don't think I worked for E.H. Daniels for more than a year, if that. But anyway, one day I get a call when I was in L.A. from a guy whose name escapes me now, and I shouldn't because he was very instrumental in my coming back here. And he called up, and this had to be in 1947, in the fall of 47, because I came back, physically moved back here in March of 48. So it had to be around Christmas time, probably. My luck holds true. Well, that was good luck. I get this call. The hell was that guy's name? Anyway, he was a guy that I knew because of the old car thing, and I had a couple of old cars and at that time, because after I got in so much trouble driving fast, the judge said, hey, you better slow down, Teague. And I was working at Northrop Aircraft, and I'd gone back there for a little while, bounced around a little bit. And a guy by the name of Don Nolan, I was working in experimental at Northrop again, the second time. At one point, I think it was before I went to Daniels. It was about a year's hiatus in there. And he said, hey, T, come over to my house someday. I'll get back to this in a second. But he said, come over to the house someday, and he said, I want to show you something. So I said, okay. And I get over there, and this has got to be a 1940. Five. When was the war over? 44?
45. Yeah.
This had to be 45, early 46. And but I was working at Northrop in advanced design, doing tech illustrations. And I did get a chance, by the way, there, Dave, to do some kind of creative things because J.K. Northrop, who was a founder and famous aircraft guy, liked all of the stuff that I was doing, but there wasn't any creativity that I was just making perspectives of something that the engineers had drawn and pull apart some machinery and wingspans and flap retractors and God, you name it. I knew every part of the damn P-51s that we were, or P-61s that we were building, as well as as the experimental flying wings, which was an interesting portion of my life because that was really good, yeah. XB-56s and the 49s and the YB-9s and all that stuff. But anyway.
I remember the Black Widow.
Oh, yeah, Black Widow. That's a P-61.
Mm-hmm.
Got a ride in that thing,
you?
Yeah. Only civilian, one of the few ever riding that thing because I became friends of the test pilot.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, Don said, come on over to the house. And he said, my wife will cook you a hell of a good chicken dinner. So I said, okay, good. I knew he was up to something, but this was a portion of his life that he kept absolutely under the blankets. I get over there, and we did, in fact, have a chicken dinner. And being single at that time, this guy's wife was a terrific cook. And anything that tasted good to me, because my mother was a lousy cook, and I didn't like to cook. So anyway, get through dinner, and he said, come on out back.